The EMS Research Podcast is a production of emsradio.com. To interact with us, go to www.researchems.com, where you can find us on Twitter or Facebook. Just search for EMS Research.
Welcome to episode number 2 of the EMS Research Podcast. We're recording this on November 3rd, 2010. My name is Harry Mueller, and I'll be your host. Our topic tonight is the use of CO oximetry in the out-of-hospital environment, and we'll be discussing a paper published in the October 2010 edition of Annals of Emergency Medicine. Before we get into the research, I'd like to introduce tonight's panel and have them tell you something about themselves. First off, Tim Noonan.
Hi, I'm a paramedic. I work outside of Philadelphia, and I've been a medic for about 17 years, and taught ACLS and PALS and NRP and paramedic school and EMT school and all sorts of other stuff. That's about it.
All right, great. Kyle David Bates.
Hey, Harry, how are you doing tonight?
Great.
Well, Kyle David Bates, a paramedic in a suburb of Buffalo in Tonawanda, New York. I'm an educator, paramedic, EMS 20 years, podcaster with firstfewmoments.com and pdu.com.
Terrific. Bill Toon, how are you doing tonight?
I'm doing well, and I've been in EMS for a long time, since 1975, and I've worked everywhere from as a provider at the basic level all the way to the paramedic level, and majority of my career, though, has been spent in EMS education, and I currently work for a county-run service just outside of Kansas City, Kansas, Kansas City, Missouri, and Johnson County, and I'm a battalion chief training for them, and looking forward to tonight's talk.
Terrific. So my background, I've been in EMS since 1980. Right now, I'm the operations coordinator for a combination paid volunteer ALS ambulance service in Durham, New Hampshire. Worked in a lot of different places, but right now I'm enjoying working in the mixed environment and doing a lot of education on the EMT basic and EMT intermediate level. So now that we've met tonight's panel, I'll give a brief summary of tonight's research paper, and then we can launch into our discussion. The paper we're discussing tonight was entitled Performance of the RAD57 Pulse CO Oximeter Compared with Standard Laboratory Carboxyhemoglobin Measurement from the Department of Emergency Medicine, Jacoby Medical Center in the Bronx. It was published in the October 2010 edition of Annals of Emergency Medicine. That's volume 56, issue 4, pages 382 to 388. The purpose of the study was to compare the measurements of carboxyhemoglobin levels taken with the Masimo RAD57 to standard laboratory testing when used with patients with suspected carbon monoxide poisoning. The study took place in the ED at the Jacoby Medical Center using just a convenient sample of adult and pediatrics in the Level 1 Trauma Center, Burn Center, and Hyperbaric Oxygen Referral Center. These patients were all seen between January of 2008 and April of 2009, and they were all patients who presented with suspected carbon monoxide poisoning and were also receiving or giving arterial or venous blood samples for carboxyhemoglobin testing. Patients with burns involving the digits that precluded proper placement of the RAD57 were obviously excluded. During that time frame, a total of 120 patients were enrolled. During the course of the examination and treatment, the RAD57 was applied by clipping it to a digit for 15 seconds, and then the value measured from the device screen. The device was removed, reapplied to the same figure, and the measurement process repeated. Then they drew arterial or venous blood, which was sent to the lab for direct measurement of the carboxyhemoglobin level. Clinicians were asked to record if the RAD measurement was technically difficult or if there was any problems with low signal quality. The RAD57 readings and the laboratory readings were entered into a database for analysis. The results were somewhat interesting in my mind. The mean laboratory percentage for carboxyhemoglobin was 2.3% with a range from 0% to 38%. The mean difference in the carboxyhemoglobin values from the lab and the RAD values was about 1.4%. The range was minus 11.6% to 14.4% carboxyhemoglobin. The researchers found that the RAD57 correctly identified 11 of 23 patients with lab values of greater than 15% carboxyhemoglobin. During the course of the study, the clinicians experienced difficulties with 12 cases. The final analysis showed no substantial difference in the results when those cases were included versus excluded. The author's conclusion was that in the range of carboxyhemoglobin values measured in the sample, the level of agreement observed suggests that the RAD57 measurement device may not be used interchangeably with the standard laboratory measurement. The authors did point out some limitations of the study. They said it was a single-center study, and they felt that because of that, the results may not be generalizable to other settings. Despite the despite the enrollment of subjects with a fairly wide range of carboxyhemoglobin levels, 0 to 38%, the majority of the patients, 97 of 120, had lab carboxyhemoglobin levels of less than 15%. They felt that this limited the sensitivity of the study. The study population was primarily Black and Hispanic in composition, limiting the ability to draw conclusions about the performance on patients with lighter skin. The authors admit the possibility of selection bias, as only 107 of the 120 patients received the repeat reading with the RAD57. They also cited as their last limitation that the study design had an arbitrary plus or minus 5% boundary for the acceptable limits. So that's a brief rundown of what the study was and what it found. What do we think of it?
Well, before we jump into the details of the study, I think that the Jacoby Medical Center is a very large facility in New York City, and they have an emergency department residency program. And this is a good example of the kinds of works that come out of the ED residency programs, is all of them have a research component as part of their residency process. So I would venture to say that several of the authors are probably residents that did this paper. And the thing I like about that is I would like to actually see more paramedic programs do some foundational research work with their students for 3 or 4 years. Like you do medical an ED residency program, but the opportunity to do some kind of fundamental principles of research with paramedics, and looking for them to try to do to get some of their work published, I think would be valuable and would help our profession. So I just kudos to the Jacoby as well as all the ED residency programs across the country that have actively participate in doing clinical research. With that said, we can go on to the study itself now.
All right, who wants to start?
I think, Harry, I was reading the study and such, and some of the listeners to our podcast may not quite understand some of the data that's given. I don't know if you're going to be able to post this study for reading, but when it gets into the standard deviations and the percentages that are off, some folks may not quite understand how to interpret that.
Well, the study is free from annals, along with the two letters, but not the editorial accompanying it. So the listeners should be able to listen to the whole, or I mean, read the whole study for free.
Yeah, we'll be posting a link to the article itself in the show notes.
And, you know, you bring up a very good point dealing with the statistics that are written within a paper. And I would encourage anyone that is new to reading research is not to get necessarily hung up on the minutia of that. Have the opportunity to, not always the best thing, they could Google some of those things to get an idea of what the authors are talking about. But any good basic statistics for dummies would give them some of the basic information they need to know to understand. And over time, as they get exposed to this, they would see the value of being familiar with this material, or it will begin to make more sense over time. And it will tell them that there is some strengths to the statistics that are being presented. So I always discourage people from letting statistics distract them from wanting to read research work.
I agree. If you don't understand all of the statistics, read through the stuff that you do understand and then go back and look at the statistics. Maybe it begins to make sense then. And even if you don't understand what's going on, sometimes looking at the charts that accompany the study will give you a better idea. Not everybody understands things in the same way. Some of us are more visual, some of us more auditory, and some of us just like to read the densely packed print. So look at it, go through everything, then go back and look at the things that you didn't get the first time, if there were any things that you did not get the first time.
Now, to talk about it a little bit more towards the practical aspects of this, what I think is very important is this is a single published article from a single center and done in an ED. So I would be careful about us drawing conclusions totally into the pre-hospital environment and how it's used in our environment and even its potential as a triage tool. So while I agree with what the author said about their limitations, again, it's a small population, it's a single center, and it's done in an emergency department. It would be much more powerful to me to see if this kind of work was done in an emergency medical service using an ED that could provide the comparison of the lab values, and we could talk about it from our point of view. So again, I think it is a little canted towards the hospital end. So if for those people who have RAD57s, I wouldn't kick them to the curb or throw them away. But as with any tool, there is limits to their accuracy. Even think of your blood glucometers that you carry. You know, there's certainly an error measurement there. As a matter of fact, all tools have some degree of an error measurement. This is still a relatively new tool, and we're going to need to find out if it's pointing us in the right direction. And I think that might be the real question. Is this tool pointing us in the right direction?
I think that's the key thing, you know, Bill, in terms of talking about that, because we actually carry the RAD57s. We use them quite a bit. We have a lot of CO monitors that go off, plus also post-fire. And just the other day, you know, I had a person that showed, you know, 3%, and I'm looking at her going, how you feeling? And she goes, fine. And she wasn't a smoker either. And I think that's like any tool we use, you know, even the monitor, you can have a dead person with a great rhythm and they're still dead. Then you have to do your assessment. You have to take everything and pull it together.
Absolutely.
Okay.
That you would draw from this is that we should not use it to eliminate the possibility of poisoning by carbon monoxide, but we should use it to help find patients who are presenting with subtle symptoms or patients where we're attributing the symptoms to something else, not as a way of saying there's no positive reading, therefore they're not toxic on carbon monoxide, because one thing I get from this study is that it's not capable of doing that. It has too high an error rate. They found that 48% of the patients who had readings over 15% were actually not picked up by the monitor. So if they're missing that many, we don't want to use it to exclude anybody from going to the hospital and getting further assessment. The way to assess them so far is still just by blood test, either venous or arterial levels of carbon monoxide, carboxyhemoglobin.
All right. Also joining us late today is Chris Montera, the Geeky Medic. So we'll have Chris introduce himself towards the end. For now, we're just going to jump back into the discussion of the paper. What else do we want to say about this?
Well, I want to comment on Tim's remark there, and I don't want to disagree with him, but I want to I don't think any single tool that we use is going to give us an absolute. Hopefully what it does is it adds to all of our other assessments that we have there. And I always think of the 12 lead. You know, the 12 lead, even if it shows no acute signs of ST elevation or depression, doesn't mean that someone's not having an acute myocardial infarction. And I think that would be the same mistake to make with using CO oximetry as well as a pulse oximetry, a glucometer, end-tidal CO2. You know, you need to be very versed in the equipment that you're carrying, you know, to know its limitations and how it can help you. I'm not sure, though, that it is the – I agree with the authors to the point where I don't think it is the panacea, that it's the all-knowing thing that tells us, oh, if it's negative here, there's nothing going on. And I always think that that's a dangerous thing, because just because there's no ST elevation or depression doesn't mean there's not some kind of cardiac event going on.
Oh, absolutely. I agree with that. And unfortunately, we see this way too much in EMS, where people look at the machines and accept that as something that makes the diagnosis for them. The reality is it's just one more tool in our arsenal to confirm what our clinical suspicions should be telling us. I have always maintained that if I can't tell the patient is hypoglycemic from their presentation and their history, it's probably time for me to move on to some other type of work.
Well, there are some patients who will present with low blood sugars and still be oriented and dry and non-tachycardic, but they're not common. The thing with this is the error rate. If you were to try to exclude patients based on 12 lead, is dramatically lower. On the other hand, with this, we don't have a lot of patients to go on. They only had 120 patients in this study, so we need to know a lot more. We don't know what the limits of this tool is, but we definitely should never consider excluding anybody from treatment because of a low reading on this monitor. It just doesn't do that.
It's interesting. I'm looking at another abstract that I found here that is an expert review of medical devices. And what I really like is in their last line, they talk about the RAD57 provides a clinical justification for screening in healthcare setting to identify patients with significant carbon monoxide exposure who otherwise would be undetected. And I thought it was interesting how they, in here, they said it, you know, they feel better with it in significant. And that would really be the, with a larger population, would be to look at it. How well does it identify people who truly have a significant exposure versus people who would have less than the significant exposure? And again, we would have to decide what is the definition of significant versus insignificant. But if it's at least identifying the majority of patients that are truly at risk versus the people that may not even seek attention, then there may be of an increased value to it. Again, I think there's going to be a need for us to see more in the literature about this device and its all of its capabilities.
Well, I think this article actually had some of that information in it, and granted it's one study with a small number of patients, but here we're looking, they had 23 patients with carboxyhemoglobin levels by laboratory test of greater than 15%, and the RAD57 only correctly identified 11 of them. So to me, that's a very significant number. Now, what we don't know is what number the machine gave when it was evaluating those patients, but to not correctly identify that the patient had over 15% is very significant, and it really highlights why people should not be just trusting the numbers that they get on their machines and really looking at the patient's clinical presentation.
Hey, I don't know if anybody else has talked about this yet, but as a I can't tell you how many times in the field when I was actively practicing, it would have been nice to have a tool, because people that have been exposed to CO aren't always feeling terrible. Yeah, they may have a headache or something like that. But if you could use a tool in the field to say, you know, I know you're not feeling terrible, but let me show you the reading and let me show you what this is really doing to your body right now. And here's the reason why. You know, most of the time it's probably not gonna, it may not change people's mind, but it gives us another tool for that diagnosis to take them in. Because I think most of the time, when I think back to my practice as a paramedic, the people that want to refuse are these, they're not quite feeling terrible, but if we had another reading to say, here you go, here's another definitive tool to say, you know, why don't we take you? Or the opposite, why, let's not take you in. So I don't know, when I think through that, I think about applying it to the street a little bit and allowing people to use it as another decision-making tool and not as a diagnostic tool. And that's really what I would hope we could use it for. And I think that should be what we use all these new widgets and whatnot for. You know, I was talking to one of our newest paramedics the other day, and he's been on the street for 14 years. And I said, what are you carrying in your pocket? He goes, a pair of gloves. And I'm like, see, so, I mean, he goes, because it's really about taking care of and talking to the patient and not relying on all those tools and things like that. Those are great, but we need to remember our clinical practice.
And listening to the patient more than talking to them, finding out what it is that is their objection or what their symptom is. And so many of us have a routine that, you know, we only get at the symptoms we're specifically looking for rather than others that are atypical but maybe important.
Well, but a lot of that. Go ahead, please.
Harry, you mentioned that we don't know what the numbers were, but if you look at figure 1 on page 4, it's a scatter plot of the lab and the RAD 57 numbers. It shows you on the left-hand side what the RAD 57 was saying that the number was, and along the bottom it has what the laboratory, the blood draw number was. So we do know what they were. You can see that there is a lot of clustering, and when you're looking at a chart like that, they should all be following that gray line, diagonal line in the middle. The farther they are from the gray line, the less reliable the machine is. You can see that there was one that was zero, according to the RAD 57, but looks like 35 by blood draw. That's a pretty big difference. Then you have another one that was less than 5 on the laboratory, the blood draw, and the RAD 57 had, looks like, a 23 for it. You have another one that is also up around 23 for the RAD 57, but it was 38 or 39 by blood draw. So there are some that wandered by quite a lot from what the blood draw was showing. Is that due to a possible error in the blood that was drawn, in the processing of the blood, in the machine that tested the blood? It's possible. We don't know. It's still a very small number of patients. There are only 120.
Yeah, it is.
I'm sorry. Go ahead, Harry.
It is a small number of patients, and I think, like Bill said earlier, this is something that we need to be looking for somebody to reproduce. We need to find a system that's willing to undertake a study of this in the pre-hospital environment, as well as see this study actually duplicated in other emergency departments, just so we have more than one set of data to look at.
I guess my thing is, when I see data that's that far out, you know, Tim, like you were saying, that makes me kind of question, you know, that data point. You know, was there an issue with that in terms of the collection or recording or something somewhere? It just seems unusual to be that far out of whack.
Well, is it something with RAD 57? Is it something with the laboratory, or is it a combination, or is it just the way the blood sample was drawn? Is it the way they had the monitor hooked up? There are many possibilities. And if the problem is with the use of the equipment, and they had a Masimo rep there to show them how to use this properly, so they should have been using it, kind of a Hawthorne effect. They should have been using it close to the ideal way, because they're not dealing with a lot of patients where you have a lot of drift in their skill level.
Well, I have a couple of questions, though, regarding the actual use of the equipment. When I think about using even a pulse oximeter, the colder, and most of the time we're using these on somebody's extremity. So using these on somebody's extremity, especially in a trauma situation where, and it looks like that was part of the inclusion criteria, was it a level one trauma, burn, and hyperbaric oxygen referral center. I haven't had a chance to really read and dive into what the inclusion criteria were for the patients, but two things come to mind. One, if these patients were compromised and they were starting to shut down, did that then lead to a CO reading on the monitor because they couldn't read the blood as adequately as it should? That would be the first one. And secondly, it'd be nice to see if they would just do a randomized study of everybody and just start sending patients through so we could actually get significant readings of more patients, say into the hundreds, just to see how close they were at. You know, and I think back to people that smoke and things like that, where you would be able to see that, and you'd be able to see the differences in laboratory values versus the RAD57, even though they may not have been within the inclusion criteria for a CO event.
These were all patients who were already going to get blood work done to check their carboxyhemoglobin level, so it wasn't including everybody available.
See, and maybe that's where it would be better to start including, to do more of a blinded study and just include as many people as you can to see
what do you compare it to?
Well, I think then over time, what you compare it to is patients that, and then you start pulling out. You say, all right, here's the patients that are smokers, and here's the patients that were exposed to carbon monoxide, here were the burn patients. And I mean, I think that but I think you have to compare it to the baseline of zero, which would be important too.
Well, you know, the danger with that, Chris, is that kind of approach is more of a, you know, the question is that a solution looking for a problem or a problem looking for a solution? And I think that there's no question a larger population and a more diverse population would certainly help. It would be interesting, actually, if you think about it, to look at one is how well do individuals, practitioners, how well are they at collecting a history and physical in determining the potential for carbon monoxide and then adding in a tool to a group of them using the pulse oximeter, the CO oximetry, and then using a baseline with the lab value. So it would be interesting to see how they compared that way. You know, for example, do people clinically identify, you know, the potential, whether through history, hopefully, and their physical exam, and then add the tool in, and then a confirmation with the lab value. So again, I think that I think it would be a mistake for any service that has the RAD57 to throw them into the trash can because of this study. And I think it's potentially premature for a physician medical director, after just reading this one study, to question if we should have them at all, the RAD57. I think it would be okay for him to say, maybe this isn't the magic bullet, and we need to look more comprehensively at this. And then hopefully he'd want to go out and read more of what's in the literature and try to see that the tool is being used in an appropriate manner within his system versus just an outright, disillusion based on just upon reading this one story. So there's lots of possibilities here, but larger number. And again, I think it would be important to do it in the out-of-hospital environment for a number of reasons, just all the environmental stuff that some of the things that Chris just touched on there. Think that these patients were all in an ED when they were having this exam done versus on the side of the road.
But what should medical director use as a reason to justify purchasing this when there's no evidence to show that it is effective at what it claims? We should be by default skeptical of everything. And if we get to the Atlantic article, that's what that is all about. There is so much potential for false positive results due to bias and many other things when we're looking at small studies on very limited data. And this is not even doing well at the stuff that it was studied for. How do you justify going out and buying this equipment when there's no evidence that it is very effective?
I agree with you 100%. And if, for example, if we didn't get all of ours purchased through a federal grant, saying that that's correct, we would have been hard-pressed to go out and make a recommendation to get these based upon the lack of evidence. We ended up with them because someone essentially gave them to us. And I don't necessarily know if they gave us to them based upon anything that was research-based. I think the idea came across someone and said, hey, let's get a grant for all of these. And I'm not saying that that was correct.
Well, but the RAD 57 people or the Masimo people are going to say, but our studies show that we really couldn't control. I mean, you're going to get the marketing.
Did you read their letter?
No, I didn't. I haven't had a chance to.
Biased letter from, I think it's the executive vice president of Masimo, saying that we should completely ignore this study because they have results that are different and that it's unfair for anybody to say anything negative about their products. It is something that just makes you wonder how this person can work in healthcare.
Well, because they're about selling devices. They're not about selling, we have to take that with a little bit of grain of salt. But I also think that it's also important that we recognize that there will be, this is one study, and one study does not prove anything. And I think that it goes back to the lack of research in our industry. And we need more places to be doing this, because let me tell you, I don't even know, how well and how effective are these at altitude? Because I'll guarantee you that when I take a patient from 10,000 feet that was grossly, puking, had all the symptoms of CO, and I drop them in elevation about 5,000 feet, taking them to Denver, their problem is solved, because by the time I get them down there with oxygen and time and decompression, which is basically what we're doing, they've resolved themselves. So, was the reading I was getting at altitude with the RAD 57 really... was it accurate? I don't know. I mean, so I think there's a lot to say about it, but I'm not really necessarily ready to throw the baby out with the bathwater until we get more results.
I think they're still working on it. I mean, they're still working on this device. We have three of them, and they were just upgraded. There's an issue. That's why they went to a pediatric fingertip. They found some problems that you couldn't use the adult on small children. And the other issue we've noticed is with the strobes from the ambulances, we have to make sure we use the finger cover. if we're outside near any emergency vehicles, because the strobes will interfere with it. But I think the thing I'd like to see, if the study is redone and recreated, is I would like to see a list of the signs and symptoms that accompanied some of those readings. Because, again, it goes with the clinical aspect. What is your clinical impression of the patient? It's, I almost want to compare it to like a D-dimer for a PE.
Yeah, they did not include anything about the symptoms and any of the particular lab values. And that was one of the big failures I saw in the study, because that gives you an idea of how you're going to use this with real patient. And without that, does any particular symptom go with a low reading, indicate a false low reading, indicate a false high reading? We don't know.
Absolutely, and I think that would help you to interpret the study, in that if you have a patient who has some gross symptoms going on and the RAD gives you a reading of 1 where the lab value comes back at 15 to 20, you'll know, okay, there's probably an issue with the machine. Whereas opposed, you have someone with no symptoms and the RAD gives you high readings and there's nothing in them, or vice versa. You know, where may have been the issue. And I think it would have been able to help locate maybe some of the potential errors with the study.
Well, and again, I want to just, there was a comment made earlier. Masimo, you know, has a, you know, I think not only Masimo, but all the people who are out there trying to create a product that will have a potential benefit to patients. And it's a double-edged sword. There's a part of there trying to do something that has benefit, but at the same time answer stockholders. So it's a difficult position for them to be within. But think about the advancements that can come out of people that are trying to develop products that can make life easier. So I know that Masimo has a really good reputation with its pulse oximetry, their straight pulse oximetry type stuff. And they took this knowledge of and moved it into an area that they thought that made sense, was monitoring of carbon monoxide. If you're not aware of it, they've also now come out with another one that does hemoglobin as a non-invasive way to measure hemoglobin. And the company has talked about looking at different light spectrums to also look at things like blood glucose and, you know, trying to develop, you know, again, for them, the tool that's going to launch them, you know, and make all of their stockholders very happy. So we can't totally say that there's not promise to the technology, but the technology hasn't gone through the rigors. And I think Chris, and someone record this that I'm saying this, you know, brings up an excellent point about how well does this work at altitude. And this gets back to what I said earlier, that I think a big limitation to this study is the fact that it was done just in a hospital ED. And I think also not having other information about the patients, you know, signs and or symptoms, is also prevents us from being able to make a good correlation to what goes on in the field. So again, it's an interesting study. I think it's important for, as Tim says, to bring up us, to make us skeptical, to make us ask questions, and to make us want to know more. But in my rambling thing here, not all manufacturers are evil and bad, but yes, they are biased. There's no question about it. We need stuff that comes from the pre-hospital setting and not done in an ED, I think. And then we also need to, again, remember how it fits into our whole clinical practice that we do in the out-of-hospital setting, that this is just one more point that might be beneficial to the type of care that we provide.
Well, I understand about protecting the shareholders and encouraging people to use a piece of equipment that we really don't know how effective it is in a way that may cause huge lawsuits against the company is not in the best interest of the shareholders. If people start sending patients home saying, oh, don't worry about it, you don't have carbon monoxide poisoning, and they go back into their home where there actually is carbon monoxide someplace where they didn't test, Masimo is going to end up as part of that lawsuit. And that is not going to reflect well on the bottom line.
I got to tell you, we do a lot of CO calls, and between the fire department and gas company, they do a pretty thorough check for carbon monoxide. They're there usually longer than we are, and we use that as part of our clinical decision making.
Or they go to altitude, as Chris said. Now, Jacoby's close to sea level, so
you gotta go down. You gotta go down. Up doesn't help. Up's worse. Down
exactly.
You gotta go down.
Yeah, I got to catch my plane. Oh,
exactly. And then
says
just
you're okay.
Well, and no, I find it interesting the scatter plot differences from the study to the Massimo site. I just, man, their scatter plot shows that they're sticking right within the right around that mean line, and I'm skeptical of any manufacturer that comes out with research that purports their. I mean, I always like research that goes and at least shows the device in real world. But was their study for their website just as controlled and things like that? I don't know. I mean, it talks a little bit about their methodology, and they used 160 participants, so it was statistically significant, but. I don't know. It's interesting. And maybe the difference is between the Massimo study and the ER study is that these people weren't the Massimo study was people that were volunteers versus the people that were actual patients and maybe actually had other compromises. And again, I go back to that idea that you can't, lies and damn statistics. But the point is that they're using the Massimo study used all their own volunteers, which were probably generally healthy, probably didn't have any other compromises. And, I don't know. I mean, you're crazy if you wanted to go ingest CO for a research study, but maybe they were paid well. I don't know. So anyway, I find a lot of interest. I'm just interested in, this study just doesn't sit right with me for some reason. I don't know why. And I'm not saying that I'm not paid by Massimo and I don't know their inner workings of their company, but we need more on this because I just don't feel like, I don't agree with Tim on this one that, yeah, okay, maybe every once in a while we find a piece of equipment that doesn't work, i.e. the stupid things we're using in the ambulances now that blink. God, when you put them on the end of the, I can't think of it right now. Anyway, again, another study comes out and says those don't work. I can't think of it. What are those things called? Anyway, I'm losing my mind.
Is it altitude?
Yeah, it pretty much is. And the sad thing is I've only had coffee to drink tonight. That's probably why I have too much caffeine on board.
Well, I think what this study has really highlighted to me, this study, the Massimo study, and Massimo's response to this study, is that we really need more information to go on. Personally, I'm a little surprised that Massimo would come out and say, disregard other studies, because our study was, perfect. I mean, I would expect that a company that makes these things and is involved by necessity in a lot of research would understand that you need multiple different centers to repeat the trials and come up with results so that you could look and say, okay, which one is closer, which one is more reasonable. And I'm not seeing that from Massimo's response. And that's really what my feeling is, that we need to see this repeated so we can get a better idea of which set of results is closer to the truth.
Definitely.
And I think that, and again, I think some of the thing that this is, again, we're just looking at a single study. As I said, I did a quick search on the topic area, and there's other work that's out there, but we still haven't seen this used in a randomized controlled trial of any kind with a large number of patients. So it's going to take a great, a large power for us to be able to prove if having this information is beneficial or not. Again, I think it's very promising. you know, that's, I think their work in pulse oximetry, in carbon monoxide, as well as their proposal for hemoglobin now that they're marketing, I think it's very fascinating. And imagine how wonderful it would be if that, if you put a single finger probe on anyone and we can get it to the point of accuracy that it could tell us things like glucose and hemoglobin and hematocrit and SpO2 and all of these different things. You know, just think of the kinds of information it would bring to us in the field if we can feel that the sensitivity and specificity, or let's just call it, hey, when it says it's this, when it says it's a duck, it's a duck. You know, that's really what it boils down to. We can have a high sense of confidence in the product. And I think when we get there, we're going to be very surprised. It may not happen in our working careers, but certainly the potential exists within people that are following us up here. And just think about it. If we could get a glucose reading from just a finger probe versus having to stick or anything like that, how powerful that would be.
I think already.
Bill, I don't think that'll ever happen, though, because the test for most of this is to draw blood. And because there's so much differences in skin turgor and differences in people's type of skin and melanin and all those issues, I don't think you'll ever find a finger probe that does that. I could be wrong.
I disagree.
And,
look at the stars. We've got tons of information about what stars are made up of. Nobody has traveled to the stars. Anybody who tells you is lying. We get this from the light. What happens when different chemicals burn? So maybe by passing light through the different chemicals, we're able to find out exactly what is in the blood. We don't know yet. Currently, there is a blood sugar device that measures, I think it's the sweat of the skin, or just touching the skin, not actually puncturing the skin, and it's able to get a blood sugar level off of the skin. So I wouldn't be surprised if in the next 5 years we have some of these things available from a finger probe.
And yeah, Tim, the game changer is the mobile iStat lab, and that's going to be the game changer, because we'll be able to do a majority of these lab tests in the field. Why not have something that costs almost the same amount of money in the back of your ambulance, and you can test troponin levels, you can test a Chem8, you could test the H&H, you can do
that's not the purpose of this discussion.
All right, we are veering off, but I'm just saying that if we're going to
talk, Chris, you're veering off.
I know I am.
Stop coming here and trying to capture our podcast.
Oh, man, you're just mean.
Mutiny.
I'll show up now.
It's a device that may be helpful. We don't know how helpful it is yet, and it needs more research. And I think that's all we can really get out of this. But you definitely don't use it to send somebody home saying, don't worry about it, the machine says you're fine.
I agree. I think it's certainly a good topic of discussion. I think, again, it has potential. It's certainly something for all of us to keep an eye on. But we need to know more, so we can really be convinced about the product. So,
well, all of our discussion so far has been related to patients that have been exposed to carbon monoxide. I don't know about anyone else's service. My service bought these especially to use during fire scene rehab. How do we work with a device like this in a scenario where the patient may not be getting a blood test? I mean, where the fire service is expecting us to use this to make a determination whether this person is capable of returning to duty or not.
Excellent point.
And I think that we have to do is we have to change the perception that the firefighters had, that this is not the definitive tool that we thought it could be, and that maybe all it could tell is clearly someone who, wow, you really need to go because of this reading, versus I can't say you're okay because of this reading. You know, it's, again, it may not give you the answer. It's it's sort of like it's having a cake but without the icing, you know, in the sense that, yeah, I know this is this thing is giving me a reading, and this reading's high, so I feel confident that you need further evaluation. But if the reading is abnormal but not necessarily high, I can't say you have not been exposed to carbon monoxide. I don't know if it's going to be that yet, if it's sensitive enough to be a true triage tool yet. So we're going to have to recalibrate our fire service people about its limitation.
We should have a study in a large city fire department where they draw blood samples and have the firefighters put this on their finger when they've been inside a fire. Come out, do this, and maybe they can do a point of testing evaluation of carboxyhemoglobin. But if nothing else, they can evaluate whether this is good for screening firefighters to determine if it's appropriate for them to go back into a fire.
Yeah, but I'd be very hesitant to be talking to any of my fire service colleagues right now and telling them that this is a definitive tool to say it's okay.
Oh, definitely not. But to test it, using a fire department to test it, it's in their interest to find some tool that is better at screening whether they're safe to go back into a fire. There are many other assessments that you want to do before sending a firefighter back in. If their heart rate's in the 150s, maybe they just need to sit down for a minute. Maybe they're dehydrated. Maybe they've been inhaling something and it's not just carbon monoxide. You have cyanide and plenty of other things in there that can affect them. But this can be one thing that helps to rule out something if it can be shown to work that way.
Okay, let's not all talk at once. Jeez.
Well, we obviously, I think we've pretty much beat this to death, this article. So maybe we have a little bit of time here before we wrap things up to talk a little bit about the Atlantic article.
Sure, I think that's reasonable. I think we can all agree our take home message is that this is a tool like any other piece of technology that we use, and we still need to use our clinical judgment when making decisions as far as transport or no transport and what we're going to treat the patient for. Does anybody disagree with that?
No, it's a largely untested tool.
Nope. Okay. Does anybody want to summarize in a short amount of time the article in The Atlantic that we're referring to?
Sure. An article by a reporter who is, in my opinion, spinning the work of Dr. Ioannidis. I probably mispronounced his name, but he's been doing great work in looking at the research that is done and finding the ways that research is giving us false positives, false negatives, and just completely wrong information. There are two main studies he came out with in 2005. One was published in Journal of the American Medical Association, and the other one was published in the Public Library of Science, which is an open source journal. The titles are Contraindicated and Initially Stronger Effects in Highly Cited Clinical Research, and Why Most Published Research Findings Are False. The way the author of the article in The Atlantic makes it seem is that this is a big shock to people in research. Well, people in research are generally aware of the problems in coming up with valid findings. He looked at, in the JAMA article, he looked at 47 or 49 of the most cited studies over several years and found that 12% of them were completely reversed, and another 12% showed findings that were exaggerated and almost always in favor of the medication or treatment that was being studied. Bias is a large part of that. Getting into a large journal is an important part of it. But he hasn't been looked at as a problem by the scientific community. And if you read this, you'd get the impression that science is not to be trusted. But this is somebody who's using science to evaluate the science. It's showing the weaknesses of science. It's showing why we shouldn't accept a study like any of the research that's been done on the Rad-57. There just isn't enough of it. It's not been well enough done to provide us with any trustworthy answers. And this looks at some of the biggest studies that were done over several years and ones that were done long enough ago that there have been further studies on the same topic. The main contraindicated studies were the ones that were on lifestyle things. If you're doing an epidemiological study, then it's possibly going to show you something that isn't really there. It's how you look at the way people record the data, how people interpret it, and what they're actually saying that they're looking for. But the work that is being done by Dr. Ioannidis is excellent work, and it is extremely important for when we decide what we should be treating our patients with. The one thing that he says that is probably most important is that we really shouldn't, let's see. I says, science is a noble endeavor, but it's also a low-yield endeavor. I'm not sure that more than a very small percentage of medical research is ever likely to lead to major improvements in clinical outcomes and quality of life. We should be very comfortable with this fact. And he says, distrust the stuff that's encouraging us to take medications. We've got people taking ridiculous amounts of pills. Go into a nursing home. 10, 20, 30 pills for one patient is not unusual. But we don't know how they work together.
You know, there's two things here, and Tim, you touched on it. And the first thing is that I'm, first of all, always skeptical of people from the news and what the motive is for writing their article. And also the Atlantic Monthly is, you know, is a I would say there's a degree of entertainment that's necessary from that magazine. But what it does is it does highlight, which is really what I think I take more is that, and you've said it, research, regardless of how well it's put together, is still dealing with human beings. And human beings, we are flawed. We're going to make mistakes. We're not going to read things. We're not going to do something. And we're trying to maybe answer too global of a problem that doesn't have one single simple solution to it. And but people, human nature, we've become very much this thing is that there's something wrong, give me a pill so I can get better and go on. So we're in a huge dilemma there. But what's important here, though, is exactly that. Look at all research, have a skeptical eye to it, read it very carefully, read lots of it on the same topic area, and then draw your own conclusions, you know, based upon your abilities to read and understand that. And that's what I took away from reading this. You know, I didn't, you know, I sort of got at the negative connotation of the author of the article about it, you know, saying everything is bad and evil. But when you really look at it, anyone who has spent any time looking at literature or looking at research literature knows that there's flaws to it. There's limitations to it. It can't answer everything for us. And if we're looking for that, that's a I think that that's a mistake. And I think even the American Heart Association, you know, not that they're the end all and be all, but in their guidelines, they even talk about that sometimes something there is such a small amount of something that it's just expert opinion that helps develop a guideline sometime, because there's a lack of information about that particular topic area. So this is what we think, you know, the smartest minds are doing right now to address this issue.
But I think Dr. Ioannidis's message is that in the absence of strong, clear evidence that the treatments are beneficial, we should avoid using the treatments, because basing our treatment of a lot of people on something that is questionable is not the right thing to do for patients. They're trusting us to know that what we're doing is good. And if all we've got is expert opinion because there isn't good research, then we probably shouldn't be treating patients with those treatments.
I don't disagree with you. So the question comes is, when are we going to stop doing intratracheal intubation? That was for you, Chris.
Actually,
get me started because I'm so ready to go there. I'll shut up.
Oh, don't go there, please.
No, Chris, don't go there.
I think that's a whole another episode.
That could be fun.
That could be several episodes.
Their podcast, like it could be its own podcast. I'm not going to start that one.
Don't, Chris.
I think when I read this article from The Atlantic, that the message that I got was that the author was trying to tell us that medical research is broken, it is beyond repair, and it is pretty much a hopeless case. And that's not the view that I really have. When I went and read the articles that were referenced, the message that I got was, you can't rely on a single article. You need to see a series of articles with similar results before you can say something is good. And I'm trying to understand how the author made the leap from the message that I got from the cited works to what was published in The Atlantic. Now, The Atlantic not being a peer-reviewed journal, I somehow doubt anyone had the opportunity to say, hey, did you think of this?
Bias. It's all about bias. He is a very biased author, and he is presenting his opinion and cherry-picking quotes from Dr. Ioannidis to back up what he thinks, not to back up what the research actually shows. There was one good paragraph in there. He says, to say that Dr. Ioannidis' work has been embraced would be an understatement. His Public Library of Science Medicine paper is the most downloaded in that journal's history. And it's not even Ioannidis' most cited work. That would be a paper he published in Nature Genetics on the problem with gene-linked studies. Other researchers are eager to work with him. He has published papers with 1,328 different co-authors at 538 institutions in 43 countries. Last year, he received, by his estimate, invitations to speak at 1,000 conferences and institutions around the world, and he was accepting an average of about 5 invitations a month until a case last year of excessive travel-induced vertigo led him to cut back. Even so, in the weeks before I visited him, he had addressed an AIDS conference in San Francisco, the European Society for Clinical Investigation, Harvard School of Public Health, and the medical schools at Stanford and Tufts. So there he points out that this is nothing that is being hidden in science. Researchers are well aware of his work. They're trying to find ways to improve science. But he spends most of the rest of his article trashing science. One of the comments to the article on science-based medicine was, you wouldn't see the same thing with alternative medicine. And imagine if there were somebody in alternative medicine who actually did the same thing. And the response was, Dr. Edzard Ernst is that doctor, and everybody in alternative medicine treats him like a pariah.
They do not embrace his work. They do not want to hear him talk. They will not pay a thing to assist him to do the research, because everything he's done has consistently shown that there is not any good evidence that alternative medicine works. Here you have real medicine that is supposed to be based on science, and you have the researchers wanting to learn, how can we do a better job? How can we avoid making the mistakes that we've been making? How do we control our biases? And they're all paying for him to come talk to him, to them. They're all interested in his work. They're all reading his work. But it's a lot of work to change what we're doing.
Well, I think we've obviously gotten to the end of this topic.
I was just about to say, we're at an hour and just under an hour and 4 minutes. I think we've covered two diverse topics that actually are somewhat related a little bit. I think the take-home message that I'm getting from both discussions is research needs to be repeatable, and research can change over time. Just because you've got what you think is a reasonable result from a study at this time doesn't mean that at some point in the future that research is going to be proven wrong. Do we have any last comments?
I want to thank everyone for taking the time, and I hope that our audience begins to challenge us with some interesting topics to discuss, as well as they themselves just get a general interest in trying to understand more of their practice and how research can help them do a better job in providing high-quality patient care.
Agreed. Chris Montero, you came in late at the beginning of the podcast. We introduced ourselves, gave us a little bit of our background. So why don't you go ahead and do that and tell us where we can find you outside of this podcast.
If you don't know me by now, I'm going to slap you, and you should be listening to my other podcasts. So anyway, that's all I'm going to say. I'm Chris Montero, Geeky Medic. You can find me there. You can find us. You can find this and all those other great podcasts at emsradio.com. And that's all. Thanks for having me on, because I'm really not a research wonk like you guys. So I just like coming on and throwing the grenade and running. So thanks.
All right. Bill Toon, where can we find you?
Well, people can find me on Twitter at WFToon, even though people claim I don't tweet enough. And then the other place is I'm also involved with the EMS Educast, and you can find also connect with me there on the on Facebook at the EMS Educast page there. So those are two good locations to find me at, and let's hear from you. Thank you.
Excellent. Tim Noonan?
One other quote I want to read. It's very short. It says, 80% of non-randomized studies, by far the most common type, turn out to be wrong. And by wrong, it's not always refuted, but it may just be that the result was exaggerated. They're showing better than placebo when actually the treatment isn't any better than placebo. It says 25% of supposedly gold standard randomized trials are found to be wrong, and as much as 10% of the platinum standard large randomized trials are found to be wrong. So the better the research, the less likely that it will be found to be wanting later on. Anyway, you can find me at roguemedic.com, paramedicine101.com, and occasionally on podcasts here, there, and everywhere.
All right. Kyle David Bates, where can we find you?
Pretty much wherever Chris Montero seems to be. He seems to follow me. But you can find me on Twitter at ImageMedic, KyleDavidBates.com. You can also find me over at my podcast, FirstFewMoments.com, and a new one that we started with Dr. Lou Romig, pediatric specific, over at pedi-u.com.
All right. Great. I'm Harry Mueller. You can find me on Twitter as the Mac Medic. Email themacmedic@gmail.com. And that's pretty much where you can find me. So this has been episode 2 of the EMS Research Podcast. We're on the web, emsresearchcast.com, Twitter, EMS Research Cast. Look for us on Facebook. Search for EMS Research. Contact us, please. We're interested in comments. EMSResearchCast@gmail.com. You can Skype us to EMS Research Cast, or you can fall back to the technology of 50 years ago and call us by phone, 603-397-0367. I want to thank the panel for being here. It was a great time. We'll be recording again in 2 weeks, where we will be discussing the Firefighter Safety and Deployment Study report on EMS field experiments. That should be great, and we look forward to seeing everybody back then. Thank you.
The best things in life are free. You can keep it for the birds and bees. Now give me money. Now give me money. That's what I want.